SC News presents The Defense Threatens.
In addition to destabilizing international weapons treaties, ballistic missile defenses, both a national missile defense system and a theater or regional missile defense system, will have a dynamic impact upon the realm of international relations. While international treaties could be seen as a rather indirect or formalized method of countries interacting, specific responses to changes upon the global scene are far more direct and reflective of a nation's perception of a political development. The actual reaction of a nation-state to the implementation of a ballistic missile shield is as equally important as ballistic missile defense implementation's effect upon international agreements and strictures. This feature is one part of two, examining possible effects of a ballistic missile shield upon the behavior and interaction of countries. This segment, part one, will concentrate upon the countries of the Korean Peninsula, the People's Republic of China, and the Republic of China, more popularly known as Taiwan. Possible effects for Japan will be touched upon, but will be covered in greater detail in Part 2. Alistair Millar, Vice President of the Fourth Freedom Forum, describes China's current nuclear weapons posture and how implementing a missile defense system could drastically alter the Chinese nuclear stance.
They've got about 18 or 20 of these things at the moment, but they have no intention, they don't have them on alert, and they don't have any intention of using them against the United States. I think what we're getting at here is if the United States appears to be have aggressive intentions by using a national missile defense system and encourages China to build up its forces, then it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy in that we have to build them up to prevent China from building more, and then because they've built more, we have to improve our missile defense system, and it just escalates into the sort of arms race that you mentioned at the outset of this conversation. So I think the distinction that you make between theater missile defense and national missile defense is important here, but it shouldn't be connected in either case to the fact that China may be building more missiles. I mean, we're only encouraging them to build more if we build either system.
Retired United States Navy Rear Admiral Eugene Carroll, now the Vice President Emeritus of the Center for Defense Information, further details how the altered condition of the People's Republic of China's nuclear policies could have drastic and far-reaching consequences.
If China starts stirring itself and expanding its nuclear programs, India is going to react. That was the basis for India's initial nuclear programs, was to confront China. If India reacts, what happens in Pakistan? They are afraid of Indian nuclear weapons directed against them. So Pakistan takes off. The whole situation becomes amorphous with no rules and no experience to guide it, and we may find that our tiny little putative defense capability leaves us more exposed and more in danger of nuclear attack than before we invested all this money.
Many people feel that a regional or theater-based ballistic missile defense would be less politically dangerous to implement than its national counterpart. Alistair Millar states why he feels a theater missile defense or TMD system would be just as politically dangerous in Asia.
I do not agree with the fact that this is a better system in that it can be forward deployed and on the ready for precisely the reason that it would upset China, to answer your question. I think forward deploying these systems on ships and in close proximity to combat zones, whether they're current or future combat zones or potential combat zones, only sort of ratchets up the problem itself and it breeds fear and is seen, I think, by other countries, particularly China with regard to Taiwan, as sort of saber-rattling. And the better thing to do would be to discuss ways in which to use a cooperative missile defense system, if necessary, to address the issue of missiles coming in from nations that are less stable, like Iraq or something, if they even had them. They don't even have them at this stage. But to use them forward deployed just seems like saber-rattling and is going to cause more trouble than it's ever going to prevent, in my opinion.
Leon Siegel, director of the Social Science Research Council's Northeast Asia Security Project, details why many in both the People's Republic of China and the Republic of China, also known as Taiwan, feel that a ballistic missile shield would be a poor idea in the region.
The thing that brought the missile issue and therefore missile defense issue to the fore in the Taiwan area was, of course, when China test fired a missile into the Taiwan Straits back a couple of years ago when the Prime Minister was going to make a private visit to the United States. That obviously aroused the right here in the United States, fueled their arguments for the need for missile defense for Taiwan. I would just note that my sense is that there are almost no people on Taiwan who truly share the right wing's passion on missile defense. Missile defense is a very complicated issue for people on Taiwan. For the people in the armed forces of Taiwan, they are incredibly dependent on the United States for their defense. If there is a confrontation with the mainland, they do need the United States for certain purposes. And therefore, if the Pentagon has a Secretary of Defense who's gung-ho about missile defense, people in the Taiwan military have to go out of their way not to offend him because they're going to need him if there's a crisis in the Taiwan Straits. And so they've tended to be very supportive in public of missile defense. But and to some extent, some of the political people have been a little, you know, somewhat supportive. I stress the somewhat because the reality is very different. The reality on Taiwan is that Taiwan direct investment on the mainland dwarfs American direct investment on the mainland. There are major projects, power dams, all sorts of things. Many of the computer chips in your computer and other specialty chips not in computers are produced by Taiwan firms, and they have the names of the Taiwan firms on them. But they are all made in the mainland. They are made with Taiwan investment on the mainland. That's what's going on here. And another thing that's going on is that something very fundamental happened in the last election in Taiwan. One way to understand it is to understand that the Kuomintang, which was at that point the ruling party in Taiwan, were the heirs of Sun Yat-sen on the mainland, Chiang Kai-shek, etc. Okay? What that party was a kind of mirror image of the Communist Party in the mainland. It owned its own factories. It was a single party. Taiwan was a one-party state. That's the way it developed. A kind of mirror image of the mainland in some ways, though with obviously a different ideological thrust. It was the same kind of party. And what happened in the last election was that the opposition party threw them out of office, which must have been a stunning development to people sitting in the Politburo in Beijing. The notion that Chinese people would oust a party like that in a free election is a stunning notion. What I'm trying to suggest here, both on the economic and political side, is a way of thinking about the problem which some people in power in Taiwan, the way they think about it privately, is that if you just give it time, politically and economically, Taiwan will take over the mainland. Now, the right wing in America thinks the Chinese are going to take over Taiwan militarily. And the answer to that is, It doesn't have the military wherewithal to do that, and it's not even close. It'll take it 15 years before it acquires the air power and the sea power necessary to do a mounted invasion. Right now, Taiwan has the air power to defeat the mainland without the help of the Americans. Okay, they don't have the sea power, but they have the air power. Now, so the long-term play here is to keep things calm enough, not confront the mainland, and let political and economic trends work their way. It's not an argument that says, gee, the free enterprise system will take over China. It's a more complicated argument. It says both politically and economically there are changes underway. And you can see, I mean, in some sense, in this view of the world, Hong Kong is the Trojan horse. It's already in part of the mainland. And it politically and economically, it is a very different place from most of China. Guangdong has gone the way of Hong Kong. And that, you know, that's the province where there's most of the economic development. Shanghai is now next. And soon you're seeing more and more of China, not only economically, but also politically, in a very different place. This is a long-term trend. It goes backwards and forwards, but the long-term prognosis, if you think of it this way, is that eventually China will be a very different place, not just economically, but also politically. That's what people on Taiwan are playing for, and missile defense gets in the way of that. Because missile defense, in effect, says there isn't one China, there are two Chinas. It's putting a kind of wall, if you will, between the mainland and Taiwan. That's not how people in Taiwan think. People in Taiwan think at some point there'll be reunification, but not with this regime, and not with this kind of regime. But eventually, when there's a fundamental change in China, Taiwan wants to be part of China. That's the way a lot of people on Taiwan think, both in the opposition party and in the now ruling party.
In addition to the ability for a missile shield to destabilize the Chinese-Taiwanese relationship in Asia, the construction of a ballistic missile defense would also have grave repercussions within other areas of Asia. Much like the attitude of people in Taiwan, the denizens of both the Korean Peninsula and Japan aren't terribly enthusiastic about missile shields either. Leon Siegel explains.
First, missile defense, if you're sitting in South Korea, has very little direct benefit, a little indirect benefit, but very little direct benefit, because the missiles that can reach South Korea from North Korea are short-range missiles, and missile defense really can't cope with those missiles. Missile defense, theater missile defense, not missile defense to protect the United States, but missile defense to protect American naval bases in Japan, which are used to defend Korea. That's where we move our forces through, particularly our naval aircraft carriers, etc. Obviously, if missile defense worked, then it might have some marginal benefit in terms of protecting naval bases. But the problem with missile defense in Asia, and this is the way a lot of South Koreans in the government and out see it, and a lot of Japanese in the government and outside see it, is that missile defense picks a fight with China. What people in that region know, the Chinese above all, but also the South Koreans and the Japanese, is that the North Koreans, at the very highest level, Kim Jong-il himself, put their missiles on the negotiating table back in October when Secretary of State Albright went to Pyongyang. Kim Jong-il essentially said, in no uncertain terms, that the North was prepared to freeze its deployment, its testing, and its production of all missiles with a range of 500 kilometers or more, meaning missiles that could reach Japan or the United States. It means the Nodong missile and the Taepodong 1 and 2, which were of the greatest concern to the United States. That doesn't affect the short-range missiles that can target South Korea. Now, that's a very important thing because it means that everybody knows that deal is waiting to happen out there. And so for us to deploy missile defense means it must be deployed against China. That's how everybody views it, the Chinese, the South Koreans, and the Japanese. For our allies in South Korea and Japan, picking a fight with China is not what they want to see happen. And that is why the South Koreans have been quite public about opposing missile defense. And why while the Japanese have not been quite so public, if you know how to read the Japanese, because they say things delicately and carefully, their position is they've put a little money into research and development, but have made clear that they're not interested in deployment. Their formal position is that Japan understands the American position on missile defense, but understanding is a very different word from sympathizing with it. And in fact, in the very next sentence, the man who used those words, who's the chief cabinet secretary, went on to say, but they don't want to see missile defense spread all over the world, meaning they didn't want it in Asia. Okay? So basically, picking a fight with China is something neither Japan nor South Korea wants. South Korea for obvious reasons. China's role is important, not as important maybe as the United States' role, but certainly important in terms of promoting reconciliation between the two Koreas. And picking a fight with China is not in South Korea's interests, because its fundamental interests are in developing the relationship with the North at this point. Japanese, the same problem. Not from the standpoint of Korea, but they don't want to pick a fight with China. That would put them in a very different position. And even though you have a rather right-wing government, or at least a rather right-wing prime minister in Japan right now, picking a fight with China is not what the right-wing wants in Japan. So it's a real problem for them.
Leon Siegel describes the possible impact of a ballistic missile shield in the Koreas within the context of weapons proliferation.
The first thing to understand about preventing proliferation is that the only way it has ever worked is if you cooperate with the countries that you're worried about. When we were worried about the Brazilians and the Argentinians going nuclear, we cooperated with them. We, in effect, bought them off and stopped their nuclear programs. When the Soviet Union broke up and we were worried that Belarus and Ukraine and Kazakhstan would hang on to their nuclear capabilities, we cooperated with them, and they gave up their nuclear capabilities. A similar thing happened in Taiwan and South Korea, both of which had nuclear programs at one point. And a combination of cooperation and some threats to withdraw cooperation, namely the threat to withdraw the alliance or weaken the alliance, persuaded them to give up their nuclear programs. Cooperation is the only way we've ever gotten countries that wanted to go nuclear to give it up. And there's a very important, powerful logic and reason why, which is that countries that want nuclear weapons are insecure. And if you go around threatening them, you only make them more insecure and make it more likely that they want to get nukes and missiles. Now, cooperation doesn't always work. It didn't work with Iraq. It didn't work with Pakistan. But when we've succeeded in preventing proliferation, it's because we cooperated with the countries we were worried about. Now, in the case of North Korea, the North Koreans clearly are showing signs that they want to cooperate and on our terms. What they want in return is they want an end to enmity, or what they call our hostile policy toward them. They want us, in effect, to be their friends. And the evidence that we're friendly is that we wouldn't try to starve them to death, which we've now clearly gotten off of. We're feeding them. But secondly, we'll go beyond that, and we really will change the relationship in fundamental ways. And for them, that's what the missile deal is about. What they want in return is a change in the relationship. Now, it seems to me if you ask the average American, do they want to be North Korea's enemy? They may not like North Korea for fairly good reasons, but being their enemy and wanting to go to war with them is not what most Americans are about. They don't regard North Korea as much of a threat. And it isn't, because it's actually been willing to give up its nuclear program and shows every sign that it's willing to give up its missile program as well if we play. Now, what happens is you have people who say the solution to, the only solution to the proliferation problem is to build missile defenses. Now, the problem with missile defenses is, first of all, we don't have them. Second of all, if we ever get something that really works, you know, it'll be years away. Even by the administration's calculations, 6 or 7. And that's assuming they can get it to work, which I think the answer is we don't know. We don't know whether it'll work or it won't. In the meantime, we can get rid of the nuclear program and the missile program in North Korea by dealing with them. So it makes sense to do that. Now, if you don't do that, the problem is that the North Koreas of the world, the Chinas of the world, Russia, they all have the means to defeat missile defense. The missile defenses we're talking about building, you know, the Bush administration people walk around saying, well, gee, you know, we put a man on the moon, you know, we can surely build missile defense. Well, let me just say one thing. The moon doesn't do countermeasures. North Korea can do countermeasures. You can design your missile to have a different trajectory. You can put, you can attach Mylar balloons to the warhead, which will confuse missile defenses. There are a whole set of techniques. Now, the Russians know a lot of those techniques. The Chinese know some of them. And a little technology sharing among those countries can go a long way to defeat missile defense. So I'm not worried that somebody will threaten to deliver something to Iran. That's not interesting here. What's interesting is that missile defense has a very hard set of technical problems, first of all, which is it has to overcome countermeasures. And it has to be proven before you spend the money to deploy it. Because if you deploy something, you know, I know there are these people who say, just deploy, it doesn't matter, even if it doesn't work. That's silly. We're not going to spend billions of dollars to deploy something that doesn't work. That makes no sense. That's the first thing. The second problem is beyond the technical. It is the political, which is if missile defense gets in the way of really dealing with the countries of concern like North Korea, that's foolish because we can have greater certainty of containing the North Korean missile program by negotiating than we can by missile defense. Let me give you an example. There is no way a country can test a missile without our knowing about it. If the North Koreans agree to a freeze on testing, we can monitor it. We don't have to be in North Korea. They cannot test a missile without our knowing it. Now, you can't test missiles in tunnels. You can test parts of missiles. You can test motors and other things. But the missile has to be fired, and you got to make sure that it works. And making sure that it works, particularly if it's a long-range missile, means that the stages each work. And the North Koreans have done some work to master staging, but they haven't gotten neither the Nodong nor the Taepodong. They've only had two missile tests the entire time we've been talking about this. Since 1990, the North has just conducted two missile tests of its own. One of the Nodong back in 93, one of the Taepodong back in 98. And both of those tests failed. If you want to develop missiles, you test them till they work. The United States can monitor that. We know when the test happens. We knew that the tests were about to happen before they happened, because we could watch them set up the test site. So you can have very good assurance that the North will not have a really good working missile if you just have a freeze on testing, which we can monitor ourselves. Never mind, go on to freeze on production and freeze on deployment. Okay, so if you want to get, there's no certainty in this world, but if you want to have pretty good assurance that you don't have a missile program in North Korea, I'd say negotiate it. Missile defense is not a sure bet, even if it does work. Because even if it does work, it can't do what you want it to do, which is to shoot down everything that gets thrown at you, no matter what countermeasures it adopts. That we are nowhere near having. The missile defense that everybody's talking about is a missile defense that can successfully shoot down a few missiles. Not all of them, not 100%. And maybe you want to pay something for that. But I'm not sure you want to base your entire security on that. I mean, the notion that the United States would wait for a country to shoot its missiles at us, and then we would shoot missiles at those missiles in an attempt to knock them all down, that that's what we'd be relying on with missile defense, seems to me absurd.
This feature contained segments of interviews with retired United States Navy Rear Admiral Eugene Carroll, now the Vice President Emeritus of the Center for Defense Information, Alistair Millar, Vice President of the Fourth Freedom Forum, and Leon Siegel, Director of the Social Science Research Council's Northeast Asia Security Project. All of the featured interviews were conducted during the last week of July and continued through to the third week of August in the year 2001. The next Defense Pretense feature will be the second part of two, examining the possible effects of a ballistic missile shield upon the behavior of and interactions between countries. The second half will look at Japan, Russia, Europe, and Canada. The music featured in this program consists of IZUS by Aphex Twin from his LP Come to Daddy and the eighth track from the first disc of Selected Ambient Works Volume 2, also by Aphex Twin. That's it for this program. You've been listening to one part in 10 of the KVSC News feature series, The Defense Pretense, a critical look at proposed missile shields. Reporting for KVSC FM News, I'm Jed Cousin.